elliptical orbits, and Hohmann transfers. And Dr. Sayer nods along, though Blair is certain he's just as lost as she is. When she can't stand being ignored another second, she clears her throat.
Oh, yes, Angus says. My wife is concerned about...
My size, Blair says. She finally has Dr. Sayer's undivided attention, and she knows she'd better take advantage of the opportunity. I'm huge. A hippo. I've outgrown every dress but this one. Dr. Sayer gives her an appraising look, then comes around his desk and puts a hand on her belly. Blair feels the baby kick.
Let's send you to X-ray, he says.
Angus chooses to stay in the examining room while a nurse leads Blair down the hall and asks her to lie on a cold metal table. While the X-rays are taken, tears leak out of Blair's eyes. She's certain they're going to find she's carrying a giant, a monster, an octopus. She regrets ever marrying Angus and allowing herself to get pregnant. She imagines her life if she had taken an alternate path. Blair Foley, slender of body and nimble of mind, becomes a renowned scholar in the field of 20th century women's literature, starting with Edith Wharton and moving on to Shirley Jackson, Flannery O'Connor, Anne Sexton, Adrian Rich. She would date different men, as Sally does, an architect one weekend, a museum curator the next. She would not be here, lying on a metal table like a side of beef, awaiting news of what horrific creature is growing within her. She would be lounging on Cliffside Beach on Nantucket. And Marco, the lifeguard from Rio de Janeiro, would watch her trim, firm backside when she strolled from her umbrella to the water. She would be having a mad, passionate affair with Marco, who would be devoted solely to her. She would not have to share Marco with a call girl named Trixie. Blair closes her eyes to better focus on her rapture, and she must have dozed off because the next thing she knows, the nurse is shaking a blurry black-and-white film in front of her face and saying, "Would you like to see a picture of your twins?" Twins. Blair bursts out sobbing. The next afternoon, there's a knock on the apartment door, and Blair suspects that, on receiving the news that there will be two grandchildren instead of one, her mother immediately left Nantucket and is now back in Boston. When Blair opens the door, she finds a tall, attractive man in a neatly pressed khaki suit. It takes Blair a moment to recognize Joey Whalen, Angus's brother.
"Joey," Blair says, "are you a sight for sore eyes? You look wonderful. What a surprise."
"A surprise that I look wonderful?" Joey says, beaming. He kisses Blair on the cheek and hands her a bottle wrapped in brown paper and a bakery bag that smells of chocolate. "Babka, right out of the oven," Joey says, "and our old friend, Cold Duck."
"You sure know how to cheer a girl up," Blair says, and she holds the door open for her brother-in-law.
Twins. Every time she says the word in her mind, it seems more outrageous. Twins. Two babies. Two babies at once. The enormous life change that is having a baby has doubled in an instant. She presently has one of everything. One bassinet, one crib, one stroller. And now she needs a second of each. It's overwhelming. Joey steps inside, loosens his tie, and sheds his jacket, while Blair admires him. Right after Angus and Blair got married, Joey moved to New York City and landed a job with a prestigious advertising agency that specializes in food products. He worked on the Sara Lee campaign and has been chosen to promote the brand in New England and parts of Eastern Canada. He's going to be in Boston for 3 to 6 months, he tells Blair. The agency rented him a suite at the Parker House Hotel on Tremont, right down the street from the Marliov, Blair's favorite restaurant, and gave Joey a house account. He's wearing a beautiful suit, tailored for him at Allen David in New York, and gleaming floorshine loafers. He's clean-cut and freshly shaved, and he smells good, in distinct opposition to Angus, who often forgets to brush his teeth and apply aftershave before he dashes headlong into his days. Blair pours two glasses of the Cold Duck for old time's sake, as Joey gets plates and a knife and slices into the warm, fragrant babka. They sit next to each other on the sofa, and Blair feels happy for the first time in a long while, despite the fact that she won't be able to get up off the sofa without help.
Babka, she says, I don't think I've ever tried it before.
New York has the greatest Polish bakeries, Joey says. I eat so much Sara Lee that it's a nice change to have something made from scratch. But I'd never tell my bosses that.
He takes a sip of his cold duck.
The other thing I love about New York is the Thai food. Have you ever had Thai food?
Thai food? Blair says. She can't believe that Joey Whalen, who used to peddle the swan boats and whose idea of a gourmet meal was the oyster stew at Durgan Park, has become so sophisticated.
She remembers how he held Angus's notebook filled with calculations over the candle flames in a plea for attention, and how, at that time, it had been crystal clear that she would be far better off with Angus. Now she's not so sure. If she had married Joey instead, she might be living in New York City, visiting the Metropolitan Museum of Art on Sunday afternoons, and hanging out in Greenwich Village with the likes of Bob Dylan and Allen Ginsberg.
How's your brother? Joey asks, which Blair supposes is a natural segue from Thai food to the battlegrounds of Vietnam.
Still alive, Blair says. He sends letters.
It's an immoral war, Joey says. Our guys are over there killing women and children.
The babies kick with the first bite of babka. Blair can't believe that Joey now has political opinions. She privately agrees the war is immoral. The last three administrations have valued the eradication of communism over the lives of American soldiers. But Blair knows Tiger is over there fighting for their continued freedom, and she's proud of him for that.
So I have two pieces of news, Blair says. The first is, I'm having twins.
Joey gives a whoop, and then, crazily, he moves the coffee table out of the way and gets down on his hands and knees in front of Blair so he can rub her belly.
That's incredible. Not one human life contained inside you, but two. Two.
His touch feels good, and Blair feels faintly aroused, sexually aroused, which is wrong on many levels. She laughs and swats at him.
Get up.
She prefers Joey's enthusiasm to Angus's reaction yesterday, which fell somewhere between apathy and scientific interest. He had studied the X-ray, trying to see if the twins would likely be identical, one egg that split, or fraternal, two separate eggs, both fertilized. And then, all the way home from the hospital, he wondered aloud if at least one of the twins would be a boy. Joey sits back down on the sofa, closer to Blair than he was before.
What's the second piece of news?
Blair takes as deep a breath as she can manage. The babies have started to crowd her lungs.
Angus is having an affair with someone named Trixie, she says.
Every time Blair says the name, she pictures a character from a Disney movie.
He meets her during the workday. She called here on the phone.
Joey's elation at the news of twins twists into something fierce and angry.
You have got to be kidding me.
I wish I were, Blair says, and she starts to cry.
Oh, hey, Joey says. Hey, Blair, come on now.
He puts an arm around Blair's shoulders, and she falls into his arms and sobs all over his fine white shirt.
Angus is a dope. He's a heel. He's never known what he has. He's so damn smart, he just takes everything as his due.
I thought he loved me, Blair wails.
I'm sure he does, Joey says. I know he does. This is just, well, he must be panicking about the moon launch, or the babies.
Panicking about the babies? Blair says. He sees the babies as my responsibility and mine alone. Babies are women's work, and rocket ships are men's work.
Blair bursts into a fresh round of tears.
Aw, Blair, don't cry, Joey says. You're so pretty and smart, and such a catch for someone like Angus. I'm sure this Trixie person doesn't hold a candle to you. I mean, how could she?
Maybe it's that these words are exactly what Blair needs to hear, or maybe it's that the hormones from not one but two babies are making Blair delirious. But whatever the reason, the next thing Blair knows, she's kissing Joey Whalen, and he is kissing her back. Blair can't believe something so outrageous is happening, and yet it feels so good that she is powerless to stop it. Angus never touches her anymore. Sex stopped last month because Blair read that it was unsafe in the final trimester of pregnancy, but along with the sex went hand-holding, back rubs, and kissing. Joey tastes of the cold duck and warm chocolate. Blair can't get enough of his lips, his tongue, his touch. She is transported right back to that afternoon on the swan boat. She had felt the same passion then, back when she thought she would be marrying Joey. One of Joey's hands travels up Blair's thigh, and one gently massages her nipple through the thin material of her threadbare dress. She needs to put an end to this, Blair thinks, right now. But instead, things heat up. Joey starts unbuttoning the front of Blair's dress. Honestly, Blair would like him to rip it off. She is just reaching for Joey's belt buckle when Angus bursts into the apartment, holding a huge bouquet of lilacs and peonies, Blair's favorite flowers. Young girl. Bright and early on Tuesday morning, Jesse and Exalta walk to the Field and Oar Club for the first day of Jesse's tennis lessons. It's so early that the shops aren't open yet, though there is the smell of bacon coming from the charcoal galley, and there's a gentleman sweeping up pieces of a broken bottle on the walk outside of Bosun's locker. "Bar fight?" Exalta asks the gentleman.
"Good a guess as any," he says,
and Exalta laughs in such a carefree way that Jesse isn't sure if she should be pleased or worried. She glances at her grandmother out of the corner of her eye and sees what appears to be a genuine smile. Maybe her grandmother is happy because she's back on Nantucket for the 100th summer in a row. Or maybe she's happy because she has finally gotten her way and Jesse has agreed to take tennis lessons. She resisted until now, her one small act of defiance. But this year, right after Tiger was deployed, Kate had begged Jesse to reconsider. It would mean so much to Nani, and Jesse, unable to disappoint her mother, had acquiesced. Jesse is uncoordinated, bordering on clumsy. She's certain tennis will only highlight her athletic shortcomings. She would rather spend every morning of the summer sitting in the dentist's chair having her teeth drilled. Jesse decides to take advantage of Exalta's good mood. "Why is Mr. Crimmins living in Little Fair?" she asks. "Oh," Exalta sings out. The day isn't yet bright enough to require sunglasses, so Exalta's are perched in her blunt-cut silver hair. This allows Jesse to study her grandmother's expression. She looks like she's trying to decide whether to tell Jesse the entire truth or just part of it. "Well, he needed a place to live for the summer."
"Doesn't he live on Pine Street?" Jesse asks. "In the house with the church windows?"
"The old steamboat terminal building," Exalta says. "Yes, he's rented the unit in the back for years and years, but that's an efficiency, big enough for only one person. And this summer, he has his grandson with him, Pickford. Bill says the boy was named after some 10th-rate musician. I had rather hoped he was named for Mary Pickford, the greatest actress of our time." Exalta seems to drift off in a reverie. "America's sweetheart. The girl with the curls. Pickford is a strong name, even if there aren't any family ties behind it. I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised to find Lorraine hadn't named her child something like Oleo or Bangladesh."
"Lorraine is Mr. Crimmins' daughter, right?" Jesse says.
"That's correct."
"You know her?"
"Knew her years ago," Exalta says. "She used to clean for me and cook. She was quite a baker, very precise with her measurements. It's a shame she ran off. She could have made something of herself."
"She cooked and cleaned for you?" Jesse says. "I never knew that."
"It was before you were born," Exalta says, and Jesse knows what that means. She often feels like everything important happened before she was born, back when Wilder Foley was alive and her siblings were young and her mother was happy. It's unsettling how much envy Jessie feels for a stretch of time. Those years, in the retelling, always sounded golden, like they could never be matched or recaptured. "I just found out Mr. Crimmins had a daughter yesterday," Jessie says. "He's never talked about her."
"Her time here didn't end well," Exalta says.
She seems to realize she's revealed too much. "Come along. We don't want to be late." The Field and Ore Club occupies 5 acres of precious real estate on Nantucket Harbor. Jessie understands that it's a fancy club, meaning exclusive, but the actual clubhouse is a simple wooden building that even Nani admits has seen better days, though it's given a fresh coat of white paint each spring. The club is populated by old people like Exalta, who have children Kate's age and grandchildren Jessie's age, and all 3 generations are supposed to care about only 2 things once they cross the club's threshold: excellence in tennis and dominance in sailing. Jessie once asked Exalta about the name of the club, and Exalta said, "It's charming, isn't it? But anachronistic. Field refers to the tennis courts, which used to be grass."
"Really?"
Jessie said. The courts were orange clay now.
"And the ore refers to boats, of course," Exalta said.
Of course, Jessie thought, except there wasn't a rowboat, canoe, or kayak in sight. Instead, there were motorboats, cabin cruisers, and sailboats of every size. Jessie grew up seeing groups of children yoked in bright yellow life preservers heading out for sailing lessons. She supposed she should be grateful to have escaped that fate. Jessie's mother adores the club because the field and ore is all she has ever known. She and Exalta come here for lunch on the patio 2 to 3 times a week, and Kate enjoys the dinner dances. She claims the club is the last bastion of elegance on this island. The hippies and the free thinkers have infiltrated every other institution. Jessie follows her grandmother to the reception desk, but then Exalta sees Mrs. Winter, whom Exalta has known since the previous century, and Jessie is left alone. The receptionist smiles at her. Her name tag says Liz. Liz is pretty with blonde hair and dazzling white teeth. Everyone who works at the field and ore is attractive enough to model in catalogs.
"I came for my tennis lesson," Jessie says. "The last name is Levin."
"Levin, you say?"
Liz scans her clipboard.
"I don't see a Levin. What time was your lesson?"
8.
Jessie holds her breath, wondering if a miracle has occurred and Exalta made a mistake. Maybe Jessie will be set free. She can go home, climb on her bike, and follow Pick to Surfside Beach. He leaves for the beach every morning at 9, he told her. Then he comes home for lunch around 2, although he sometimes gets a burger at the shack. He goes into work at the North Shore at 4:30, gets home between 10 and 11, and does it all over again the next day. Suddenly, Exalta swoops in. "Jessie has a tennis lesson at 8. Jessica Nichols."
"Nichols," Liz says. "Ah, okay. She told me Levin."
"Levin is my last name," Jessie says.
"Nichols," Exalta says. "Nichols is the member name."
"I'll go tell Garrison you're here," Liz says. "You can head out to Court 11.
"The court closest to the water," Exalta says. "Aren't you lucky?"
"I don't understand," Jessie says as they start walking.
"Mom uses the name Levin when she comes here."
"She does that only to distress me," Exalta says.
"And Blair, Kirby, and Tiger use Foley,"
Jessie says. There's a challenge in her voice.
"Right? They do. You and I both know they do."
"Foley is different," Exalta says.
"Because it's not Jewish," Jessie says. She stops in her tracks. She can't believe the fury that has taken hold of her. She grips the handle of her racket, which Exalta bought her brand new for these lessons, a Jack Kramer autographed Wilson. She would like to smash it against the brick walk.
"No,"
Exalta says, because Lieutenant Foley was on his way to becoming a member here before he died. Your father has no interest in becoming a member here.
Jesse wants to ask if he could become a member here if he wanted to, but the words get stuck. The sun is beating down on the part in her hair, and she can see a boy in white standing patiently outside the court closest to the water. Garrison, her tennis instructor.
I'm not taking my necklace off, Jesse whispers angrily.
No one is asking you to, Exalta says. Jesse fears that Exalta is going to stay and watch Jesse's tennis lesson, offering commentary and criticism. But the allure of drinking mimosas on the patio with Mrs. Winter proves too great. Exalta hands Jesse over to her instructor and says, I'll see you in an hour. Listen to this gentleman, please. And then to Garrison, the instructor, Exalta says, Under no circumstances are you to teach her a two-handed backhand.
Yes, ma'am, Garrison says.
His voice has a southern twang. Jesse realizes she was wrong in thinking that everyone who worked at the club could be a catalog model, because Garrison is funny-looking. He has a long torso and long, thin arms and legs, and the way he holds his racket vertically in front of his chest reminds Jesse of a praying mantis. He wears thick glasses that make his eyes look small and far away under the shade of his visor. Jesse had been hoping to get Topher for her instructor. Topher has thick brown hair and a strong jaw and is popular with ladies of all ages at the Field and Oar Club. Last year, Jesse overheard her mother say, My goodness, that young man is handsome. Topher might have made the tennis lessons bearable. Jesse waits until Exalta is out of earshot, then she offers a hand.
I'm Jesse Levin, she says. Levin, not Nichols.
Garrison Howe, he says.
He glances back at Exalta.
That your granny?
Jesse sighs. Yes.
She's all business, Garrison says. I like it.
Exalta called Garrison a gentleman, but the first 5 minutes of their acquaintance reveal that Garrison is only 19 years old. He's entering his sophomore year at Sewanee, a men's college in Tennessee. He applied for this job at the suggestion of his tennis coach at Sewanee, who went to summer camp with the pro here.
And by Jeezy, if I didn't get the job, Garrison says, probably because everyone else is off fighting the gooks.
Jesse bristles at the term. Her father has informed her it's a racial slur.
My brother is in Vietnam, Jesse says.
She hopes this news will make Garrison more kindly disposed to the ungraceful and unskilled display he will no doubt witness while teaching Jesse tennis.
He's your age, 19. If he'd stayed in college, he would be a rising sophomore, just like you.
Garrison stares at Jesse. She wonders if it was rude to point out that her brother is serving their country in the swampy jungles of Vietnam, while Garrison is here doing this cushy job at the Field and Oar Club. Maybe he's going to say something rude in return. Maybe he's going to express a strong anti-war sentiment. And what will Jesse do then? Will she stomp off the court and demand a new instructor? She, too, is anti-war. Her entire family is anti-war. These feelings coexist simultaneously with concern for and pride in Tiger. Finally, Garrison speaks.
You have pretty eyes, Jesse.
Jesse is so taken aback by this non sequitur that she laughs.
I like a woman with dark eyes, Garrison says. I find them mysterious, and I love long dark hair like yours. I guess you could say I'm a brunette man.
He holds the gate open and ushers Jesse onto the court.
Now, let's play some tennis.
Like many sports, tennis is deceptively simple. The objective is to hit the ball over a net with a racket, wait for one's opponent to hit it back, then hit it again. But also, like many sports, there are nuances. Speed, power, and an elusive element called spin, which depends on the angle at which you hold the racket and the way you hit the ball. Garrison starts with the basics, forehand grip and forehand stroke. He places Jessie's hand in position, then stands just behind her and shows her how to move her arm.
"You might try loosening up," Garrison says. "You're very stiff, which will result in wooden play."
Jessie can't loosen up. The words "wooden play" give her a vision of a figure like one of her grandmother's whirligigs, a girl holding a racket that swings again and again. Jessie is disconcerted by Garrison's body positioned so close behind hers, his hands on her arm and back, and, most alarmingly, his declarations right before they began. She has pretty eyes? He likes her dark hair? No one but her parents has ever told Jessie she's pretty, and even those statements had been whittled down to a single aspect or instant. "You look lovely in red. You've been blessed with beautiful skin. That dress is becoming." Jessie has never had a boy tell her she's pretty, and she might have been tempted to think Garrison was making fun of her, but she could tell he was speaking in earnest. Garrison has a cart filled with bright yellow tennis balls, and he drops each one with a precise bounce so that when Jessie swings the way he showed her, the ball clears the net with inches to spare again and again. She's doing it. Garrison calls out words of encouragement.
"Way to go! Good job! Keep it up!"
As Jessie hits the entire cart of balls with only two that smack the tape at the top of the net and fail to clear.
"And no bloopers," Garrison says. "That's impressive. I believe you just might be the next Billie Jean King."
Jessie knows he's exaggerating, but hope unfurls in her chest nonetheless. She wonders if maybe she will prove to be good at tennis. It stands to reason, after all. Exalta is good at tennis, or she was, and both Kate and David play. Jessie's siblings all took the obligatory year of lessons, but none of them showed any real promise. Perhaps all of the tennis genes fell to Jessie. She grows warm thinking of how proud Exalta will be of her if that's the case. Jessie may even replace Kirby as the favorite.
"I think we should move on to backhand," Garrison says.
Together, he and Jessie gather up all the balls. At one point, Jessie catches him looking at her, and she feels... what does she feel? Something brand new. She feels desired. They move on to backhand. Jessie steels herself for the challenge. Garrison says,
"Your granny was clear that I am not to teach you a two-handed backhand, but I don't think you're going to have the arm strength to clear the net with one hand."
Jessie is disappointed to hear this. "Can't I try it?" she asks. She's terrified of not following Exalta's exact instructions.
"We can," Garrison says. "Maybe you'll surprise me."
He shows Jessie how to hold the racket, his hand lingering on her arm and back even longer than before. His touch makes Jessie self-conscious. Garrison drops the ball, and Jessie swings and misses completely. Garrison drops a second ball, and she misses again, and then yet again on her third try. Her eyes brim with tears of humiliation. She's hot, she's sweating, she's certain she smells. She should never have let herself believe she would be any good at this game.
"Let's try a two-handed grip," Garrison says. "It's easier. Here, I'll show you."
He stands behind Jessie and wraps his arms around her so that his chest is pressing up against her back. She tenses. He speaks into her ear, his voice nearly a whisper.
"Just relax, relax. Send your arms back like this, and then follow through."
With the movement, Jessie feels a part of Garrison poking her. She prays she's imagining it, but then she feels it again, hard and straight as the handle of a racket. His erection. The word plucked right out of the puberty talk they all received at the end of the school year. Garrison has gotten an erection from showing Jessie how to hit a backhand, and now that erection is rubbing against her. Jessie tries to pull away, but Garrison holds her arms in place. "I don't feel well," she says, but Garrison doesn't respond. He stands behind her, rocking back and forth with the ostensible mission of showing her how to swing her racket. At that instant, the horror becomes more than just Garrison and his erection. It's also Exalta disrespecting Jesse's last name and Tiger at war in the jungle. Jesse twists out of Garrison's arms with a strength she didn't know she possessed, and she runs off the court and over to the patio, where Exalta is signing the chit. There are empty champagne glasses in front of Exalta and Mrs. Winter. Exalta beams at Jesse. Her eyes have that glint that only alcohol produces in her.
How did it go?
Jesse clears her throat. I'd like a different instructor tomorrow.
What? Exalta says. Whatever for?
Jesse widens her eyes, hoping to convey her distress. Her grandmother was quite beautiful in her day. Surely she received her share of unwanted attention. But Jesse doesn't have the words to explain what happened, much less in front of Mrs. Winter. Tumescence, she thinks, the word from Blair's novel. She hears Blair say, there's no reason to be grossed out by sex. But she is. He taught me a two-handed backhand, Jesse says. Exalta pushes herself up from the table. Does the boy not have ears? That won't do at all, she says. We'll find you someone else. A girl, Jesse says. Please. Mrs. Winter is stuck to Exalta like lint to a sweater. And when Mrs. Winter says, tell me, Exalta, how is Blair? She married an astronaut, didn't she? I've always been so fond of her, even though she broke my Larry's heart. Jesse excuses herself and goes to the locker room. She splashes water on her face. It's burning. Whether from the sun or the humiliation she just endured, she isn't sure. The sensation of Garrison rubbing up against her won't go away. It's like he's branded her. She wants to cry, wants to scream, but she's at the club, so she can do neither. When she gets home, she'll tell her mother what happened, and Garrison will be fired and sent back to Tennessee. But Jesse fears she will never, ever have the courage to tell her mother. Nor can she imagine telling her father. She could tell Blair or Kirby, but her older sisters aren't here. They've abandoned her. When Jesse emerges from the locker room, Exalta is still out on the patio chatting with Mrs. Winter. Jesse wants to leave and just walk home by herself, but she knows there would be a price to pay for such rudeness, and so she lingers at the reception desk. Liz has vanished. The desk is unmanned. On a shelf just behind the desk are polo shirts, visors, cocktail napkins, and stationery emblazoned with the Kelly Green and White Club Burgee. Jessie's blood quickens. She glances around, sees no one. She leans over the counter and snatches the first thing within reach, a pair of terry cloth wristbands packaged in cellophane. The cellophane crackles. Jesse thinks that surely someone will appear and ask her for Exalta's member number so her account can be charged. But no one notices, and Jesse stashes the wristbands in the roomy pocket of her tennis skirt. She goes to wait for Exalta on the front porch. Everyday People. After 21 years of swimming against the tide, questioning authority, rebelling against the rules, and making poor decisions, Kirby Foley is surprised to find that quiet order and routine are the best parts of her front desk job at the Shiretown Inn. The inn has 12 rooms, each with an ensuite bath, and because of the location in downtown Edgartown, the clientele is upscale, as Mrs. Benny promised. They have a few honeymooning couples, but most of the guests are Kirby's parents' age or older. During Kirby's first week of work, she finds everyone she comes in contact with polite and delightful. Her shift quickly develops a rhythm. Between the hours of 11 p.m. and 1 a.m., the guests return from their evenings out, dinner at the dunes, bonfires on the beach, a nightcap on the deck at the Navigator. Kirby has been trained by Mrs. Benny to look for signs of trouble, but all of the guests seem happy and relaxed, maybe a bit tipsy, although not problematically so. Kirby's favorites are the Eltringhams from New Hope, Pennsylvania. Kirby simply adores the name New Hope and applies it to her own situation now. After two arrests, and the unspeakable situation with Scotty Turbo. For her, living and working on the vineyard offers just that, new hope. Mr. Eltringham is a banker in Philadelphia, and Mrs. Eltringham owns a small antiques shop in the village of New Hope. It's the second marriage for both Mr. and Mrs. Eltringham. Mr. Eltringham has grown up children by his first wife, and Mrs. Eltringham, in her life before him, was a nurse in the burn unit at St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City. Kirby is surprised at how much she learned about the Eltringhams with just a few thoughtful questions. On Kirby's third night of work, the Eltringhams bring her a piece of peach cobbler from the Art Cliff Diner. The gesture is so unexpected and so kind that for a second, Kirby is suspicious. But the cobbler is delicious. Kirby needs to start trusting people again. The overnight shift isn't easy by any means. Right around 2 a.m., Kirby starts to nod off. By then, she has reviewed the bills for guests checking out in the morning and has tidied the small lobby and made sure that all 12 room keys have been claimed. She nearly yearns for some drama, an unclaimed key, for example, or a noise complaint, because then there would be an impetus to stay awake. Kirby sometimes steps out to the front porch to reinvigorate herself with the fresh night air, and she does that now. She takes in the silent, dark streets of Edgartown and tries not to think about everyone else on the island fast asleep. Kirby wonders how things are going 11 miles away on Nantucket. When Kirby called her mother from the house phone to tell her about the job, Kate responded, "Oh, good for you," and then informed Kirby that Blair was having twins. Kirby had been irritated to have her good news trumped. Of course Blair was having twins. Anybody with one good eye could see that Blair was big enough to require her own zip code. "How's Jessie?" Kirby asked. Poor Jessie was pretty much raising herself, Kirby suspected, while Kate fretted about Blair and Tiger. Jessie was a sensitive kid and smart. She liked to read and daydream. Kirby had tried to imbue her younger sister with some of her own passion and ferocity, but it hadn't taken root yet. "Jessie?" Kate sounded like she didn't know who Kirby was talking about, and that said it all. Kirby decides that when she gets her first paycheck, $90, she'll buy Jessie a tie-dyed t-shirt that says Martha's Vineyard across the front, and she'll mail it to the house on Fair Street and suggest Jessie wear it to the field and ore. That will get Exalta's goat. Kirby should write a handbook called How to Horrify Nani and Get Away with It. She laughs at the dark street, then goes back in, settles down in the armchair in the back office, and turns on the small radio for company. The song playing is Procol Harum's A Whiter Shade of Pale. Kirby loves the song, but it had been playing in Scotty Turbo's car on the way up to Lake Winnipesaukee. Kirby and Scotty had thrown their heads back and sung at the top of their lungs that her face, at first just ghostly, turned a whiter shade of pale. She turns the radio off. She wakes up with a start when Mr. Ames, the night watchman, dings the bell on the front desk. Kirby hops to her feet, straightens her skirt, and hurries out to greet him. Mr. Ames is in his mid-60s. He's a former policeman from South Boston who retired to the vineyard with his wife, Susanna. They live in a cottage on East Chop, which is technically a part of Oak Bluffs, though not the Methodist campground part. During Kirby's first night on the job, Mr. Ames showed Kirby a snapshot of Susanna, and Kirby was shocked to find that Susanna was black. Kirby had tried not to let any surprise show on her face or in her voice. "She's beautiful. How did you two meet?"
"In Boston," he said. "We both rode the red line of the T, and I would see her every now and again in her nurse's uniform. One day the train was crowded, and I offered her my seat."
"That's so romantic," Kirby said. "Do you have any children?"
"Susanna has a daughter from her first marriage," Mr. Ames said, "but Denise is grown and has kids of her own now."
Kirby had wanted to ask if it was difficult being part of an interracial couple, or if it was no big deal. Her interest in this topic was pressing. Ever since Darren had picked Kirby up hitchhiking, her mind kept returning to him. She wanted to see him again. Mr. Ames hands Kirby coffee in a styrofoam cup.
"Thought you might need this," he says. "I remember that you take it sweet and light."
"Thank you," Kirby says. It's 3 o'clock now. She can't imagine staying awake another 4 hours. "Everything okay upstairs?" Mr. Ames does 3 walkthroughs, one at 11:30, one at 2:30, and one at 5:30.
"The gentleman in room H snores like a black bear," Mr. Ames says, "though I'm hardly one to talk."
He points a finger at Kirby.
"There's no shame in dozing off. If there's an emergency, I'll wake you."
"Thank you, Mr. Ames," Kirby says. She takes the coffee to the back office and thinks about how much she enjoys living without shame. Shame. There's a far bigger problem with Kirby dating Darren Fraser than just his being black. It's his mother. Dr. Fraser knows who Kirby is, maybe. Or maybe all young blonde students look the same to her. Kirby should forget about Darren. The last thing she needs is a complicated relationship. Although what appeals to Kirby about Darren is that he seems so easy. He was nice enough to pick her up and drive her all the way to Edgartown. He's smart enough to go to Harvard. He takes pride in his summer job. He's confident and self-assured. And he has a gorgeous smile. How divine would it be to bask in that smile all summer long? How lovely to ride shotgun in Darren's Corvair and go pick up lobsters from Larson's and eat them in the blue fairy tale house. Kirby sighs. Divine, lovely, but just a dream. He was nice to her because she's friends with Rajani. Possibly he's interested in Rajani. This thought bothers Kirby more than it probably should. She tries again with the radio and gets Peter, Paul, and Mary. "The answer, my friend, is blowin' in the wind." She closes her eyes. Kirby wakes with the sun at 5:15 and snaps into action. She goes through the bills one more time and hurries to the restroom to freshen up. She sets up the coffee percolator and arranges powdered donuts from a box on a plate for the guests. At precisely 6 o'clock, a guest named Bobby Hogue from room 3 appears in a pair of shorts and tennis shoes. Bobby Hogue is missing his left hand. It was blown off by a grenade during a search-and-destroy mission in Quang Nam during his second tour with the Marines. "Once a Marine, always a Marine," Bobby Hogue says, so he still gets up early every day and goes for a 5-mile run. "Good morning, Mr. Hogue," Kirby says.
"Good morning, Kirby," Bobby Hogue says.
The newspapers land with a thud on the front porch, and Kirby rushes out from behind the desk to get them, but Bobby Hogue picks the bundle up with his right hand and sets them on the pedestal table in the middle of the lobby. Kirby feels a rush of admiration, then sneaks a glimpse at the rounded stump where his hand used to be.
"I'm not going to read the news today," Bobby Hogue says.
He gives her a kind smile. Kirby has told him that her brother is stationed in the Central Highlands.
"And you shouldn't either."
"Deal," Kirby says. She's only too willing to play along, to pretend that the rest of the world is as serene as Edgartown, Massachusetts, at 6 o'clock on a summer morning. Bobby Hogue waves to her with his stump, then runs down the porch stairs. On her first day off, Kirby decides she'll try Inkwell Beach. She has considered it every day since Darren extended the invitation, but she's exercised uncharacteristic restraint. She thinks about her first heady days with Scotty Turbo, how eager she was to climb into his convertible and drive up to Lake Winnipesaukee. She had been a fool once, but she wouldn't be again. Monday is picture perfect. Warm sun, low humidity, a silken blue sky, a delicious breeze off the water that Kirby enjoys through the open window of Mr. Ames's pickup truck. Kirby had spent $6 precious dollars of her disposable income on taxis to and from work, before Mr. Ames saved the day by offering to drive her back to Oak Bluffs in the mornings, since they kept the same schedule. Normally, both Kirby and Mr. Ames are too tired for conversation, but on Monday morning, Kirby is excited about the day ahead.
"I'm going to Inkwell Beach," Kirby says to Mr. Ames. "Do you ever go there?"
"Used to when I was younger," Mr. Ames says, "with my wife's family." He pauses. "You and your friends might like Katama or the State Beach better."
"I don't really have any friends yet," Kirby says. "I mean, I have one friend from college who's working as a nanny out in Chilmark, and I'm becoming friendly with a girl who lives in the house with me."
"So what's the interest in Inkwell Beach?" Mr. Ames says, "if you don't mind my asking."
"I met a boy who invited me," Kirby says. "Darren Fraser? He's a lifeguard at Inkwell."
"Yes, I know Darren," Mr. Ames says. "My wife's sister is married to Judge Fraser's cousin."
"Right on," Kirby says. Darren is the son of Dr. Fraser, who may or may not know about Kirby's unfortunate past, and of Judge Fraser, who may or may not have access to Kirby's arrest record. Darren Fraser is the last boy in Massachusetts that Kirby should be interested in.
"Darren invited you to Inkwell?" Mr. Ames says.
Kirby nods.
"Well, okay then," Mr. Ames says. "Have fun."
Kirby is too nervous to join the other girls for breakfast, and she is too agitated to sleep or even nap. She heads straight up to her room and puts a record on her Silvertone, Stand by Sly and the Family Stone, the album she brought for her hopeful moods. She turns the music up as loud as she dares. One of the Irish M's, Michaela, came storming upstairs a few evenings earlier when Kirby was playing Crosby, Stills, and Nash, her introspective mood album, and said in her thick Irish accent, "Tiernit Doon!" To which Kirby responded, "Sorry, I didn't know you were 50 years old." Kirby puts on her red bikini and over it an extra-long tie-dyed T-shirt that has a hand-painted peace sign on the front. She wore this T-shirt with jeans and a pair of fringed suede boots to the protest where Scotty arrested her. He had cherry-picked her out of that teeming crowd because she looked so good in that top, he'd said. Kirby ties a red bandana over her hair, out of its bun for the first time in a week, and puts on her sunglasses. She's ready to go. She needs a sidekick, an Ethel to her Lucy. Rogini nannies all day during the week, so she isn't an option. Kirby hurries down the stairs with her straw bag, which still contains sand from Matakisham Beach, and a handful of shells that Jessie collected, and knocks on Patty's door. Patty is still in her pajamas. She's eating a payday bar.
"I got drunk last night," she says, "with my brother's friends. I let one of them, this rich kid from New York City named Luke, get to second base."
"Second base, huh?" Kirby says. "You liked him, then?"
She leans against the doorframe and watches Patty blush. She misses having girlfriends, she realizes. In a dorm at an all-girls school, there was no shortage of gossip like this.
"He's cute," Patty says. "I couldn't believe he was interested in me. But he told me he likes full-figured girls with long hair he can pull."
This makes Kirby laugh.
"He probably just meant he likes beautiful girls like you."
She pokes Patty in the arm.
"Come to the beach with me today, will you?" "I need to go back to bed. I was up late and I work tonight," Patty says. "But maybe I'll meet you later."
"Where are you going?"
"Inkwell," Kirby says.
Patty makes a sharp noise, a bark or a yelp.
"Didn't anyone tell you?"
"Tell me what?"
Kirby says.
Patty lowers her voice. "That's the Negro Beach," she says. "Inkwell, meaning black. Get it?" Kirby feels her stomach lurch.
"I know," she says.
Suddenly, her cheeks are burning, and she can't decide if she wants to retreat or fight. Fight, she thinks.
"I met someone who's a lifeguard there. He invited me."
Patty stares at Kirby for a second, and Kirby wonders if her favorite of all the girls in this house, the one she pegged right away as a potential friend,
is going to turn out to be a racist. She is suddenly 16 years old again, sitting in her civics class and overhearing Steve Willard and Roger Donnelly call Miss Carpenter, who was Kirby's favorite teacher, the N-word. Kirby had stood up and spat on Roger's desk, which had caused a giant brouhaha, and Kirby was the one who had been kept after class. When Miss Carpenter asked what on earth would cause Kirby to do something so beneath her, Kirby refused to say. She didn't have the heart to tell Miss Carpenter that she had been defending her. Miss Carpenter must have intuited this, however, because she said, "The best way to combat behavior or language that you find offensive is to peacefully protest. Do you understand me, Catherine?" Kirby said she did understand. She'd apologized and scrubbed Roger's desk, and the next week, Miss Carpenter asked Kirby to march alongside her with Dr. King. "I support the civil rights movement," Patty says, and Kirby exhales in relief. "My sister Sarah was one of Robert Kennedy's boiler room girls, but I still can't go with you." "Why not?" Kirby says. She's impressed that Patty's sister worked for Bobby Kennedy, but if Patty believes Inkwell is an inferior beach because it's frequented by Negroes, then she's a racist. "Because we don't belong there," Patty says. "They don't want white people there." "Darren invited me," Kirby says. "He didn't seem to think it was a big deal, and he knows what color I am. The times, they are a-changin'." "Not that much," Patty says with a wistful smile. "You'll see." Kirby marches off to Inkwell on her own, her head held high. She entertains some ungenerous thoughts about Patty. Patty must have loose morals if she let a boy she doesn't even know get to second base. And clearly, she has zero willpower. She says she wants to lose 25 pounds, but the second she wakes up, she reaches for a payday bar. She must keep a stash of them in her nightstand. And what kind of boy says he likes long hair that he can pull? Some kind of maniac? Kirby doesn't want to think badly of Patty. Right up until that conversation, she liked Patty. It's possible Patty doesn't know any non-white people personally. Kirby decides she'll introduce Patty to both Rajani and Darren. Her goal this summer is to turn Patty into a progressive. Kirby walks onto Inkwell Beach as though it's the most natural thing in the world, and in some ways, it is. Summer for Kirby has always meant sun and sand. Her mother brought her to Steps Beach on Nantucket when she was a baby, and they returned to Steps each summer until their father died. After that, Kate replaced their babysitter Lorraine, who ran off, with a babysitter named Ivy, nicknamed Poison Ivy by Blair, who started taking them to Cisco Beach, where the big waves were. Blair had been afraid to swim, but not Kirby or Tiger, and to this day, Kirby feels the most alive when she's jumping waves and then drying off in the sun. When she was little, she was famous for not even bothering with a towel. She would just lie right down in the sand, and when she stood up, she was breaded like a fish stick. Inkwell Beach is on the sound, so the water is calmer than Kirby likes, though it's hard to argue with the view. The water looks like a blue satin sheet. It's not so different from Steps Beach on Nantucket. There's a group of women who have arranged their chairs in a semicircle to facilitate conversation. Some of the women wear hats, and others raise their faces to the sun. At the shore, little kids dig for china, and girls with plastic buckets collect shells. Teenagers are up to their waists in the water, splashing one another. Beyond them, an older gentleman swims a slow but steady freestyle. There are two guys around Kirby's age lying on towels. One is asleep on his stomach. One is reading Slaughterhouse-Five, his face inscrutable behind his sunglasses. Everyone is black. Everyone. Well, right. What did Kirby expect? She expected everyone to be black, but what she didn't anticipate was how this would make her feel. She doesn't feel threatened, certainly, or intimidated. She feels conspicuous, as though everyone notices her, and what people are thinking isn't that she's thin or fat or pretty or ugly. No, those things don't matter. What matters is that she's white.
She walks past the semicircle of women, and their conversation drops off for a second, then starts up again in hushed tones. Kirby thinks she hears her name, but obviously that isn't possible. She moves closer to the water, past the little kids digging. They look up at her but appear unfazed, which heartens her somewhat. Children are colorblind. The young man reading Vonnegut glances up and shakes his head at her, as if he's warning her to go away. He's as bad as Patty. Surely he understands that Kirby has as much of a right to be here as anyone else. Patty's words echo, "We don't belong." Kirby hears a whistle and turns to see Darren, who's perched on the white latticed lifeguard stand. He's waving at her? She checks the water behind her. There's no one. And then walks through the sand in her bare feet, her huarache sandals dangling from two fingers as though she doesn't have a care in the world. "Hey," she says. She feels like Darren just threw her the life preserver that's hanging from the side of the stand. "You came," he says. "I can't believe it."
"Of course," Kirby says, shrugging. "Today is my first day off, and it's an easy walk from the house."
"Great," Darren says, and she tries to read his face and his tone to see if he really does think it's great. "Welcome to Inkwell Beach. This is where I grew up."
"It's pretty," Kirby says truthfully.
Darren's gaze floats over Kirby's shoulder, and his smile tightens. Kirby turns to see one of the women from the semicircle standing up with her hands on her hips. It's a woman wearing a floppy hat.
"My mother," Darren says, and Kirby's spirits hit the sand. "She wants me to get back to work, I guess."
"I met your mother," Kirby says.
She waves, but Dr. Fraser just glares.
"At your house."
"She told me," Darren says.
"Did she say anything about me?" Kirby asks.
Darren shakes his head.
"Just that you showed up with Rogeny."
He stares at the ocean.
"She doesn't like it when I get distracted from my job."
Is that what she doesn't like? Kirby wonders. Or does she not like white girls distracting Darren from his job? Or does she not like Kirby Foley, a.k.a. Clarissa Bouvier, the name Kirby made up back in Boston, distracting Darren from his job? Does Darren's mother know that Kirby is Clarissa Bouvier?
"Thanks for coming to say hi," Darren says.
He's leaning forward now in an active posture of lifeguarding, and Kirby can see he's eager for her to leave.
"I'll swing by your house sometime this week and take you to the carousel. Would you like that?"
She should say no. She isn't interested in riding the carousel, and even if she were, she shouldn't encourage Darren. A relationship between them wouldn't work. But, as usual, Kirby doesn't listen to her own good advice.
"I'd love it," she says. "I'll see you later this week, then."
She wanders off the sand at the next set of stairs, then stands on the hot sidewalk in a daze. Was that a failure or not? Not, Kirby decides. Darren asked her to come see him at Inkwell, and she did. The next move is his. It's still early. Kirby decides she will hitchhike to the South Shore and pass out on her towel. She's exhausted. No sooner does she stick her thumb out than an olive-green Willys Jeep pulls over with a couple sitting up front, but plenty of room on the back bench seat for Kirby. The guy driving is cute. He's wearing a white polo shirt and sunglasses. The girl has her long dark hair braided down her back. Then Kirby realizes the girl is Patty.
"Hey, Kirby," Patty says. "Meet Luke."
Kirby grins.
"Hey, Luke," she says.
"Glad to see somebody got this girl out of bed."
She climbs into the Jeep and even feels a small surge of excitement when Patty lifts her hands in the air.
"Katema, here we come."
More today than yesterday. Sunday, June 22nd, 1969. Dear Tiger, I was hoping Dad would bring a letter from you when he came yesterday,
but he said none had arrived, which put me in a bad mood, and Mom in an even worse mood. She got drunk last night at the Skipper, and not the kind of drunk where she came home singing, but the kind where she came home crying. Nani slept right through it because she started with her Hendrix and tonics at 4 o'clock instead of 5, even though she was supposed to be minding me while Mom and Dad were out. She went up to bed at 7 and put in earplugs. I made a peanut butter sandwich and watched My Three Sons in the den. I hate my tennis lessons. Jessie crosses this last line out. She will not complain about tennis lessons while her brother is loaded down with 40 pounds of gear and slogging through hip-deep water in the rice paddies. Jessie does hate her tennis lessons, but most of that hate is due to her experience with Garrison. Just walking into the field and oar makes Jessie queasy now. Exalta still refuses to let Jessie use the name Levin when she signs in or when she signs for something, like after her most recent lesson, when she went to the snack bar to get a chocolate frappe and a grilled cheese. N3, Exalta had called out as Jessie headed to the snack bar. Nichols! Jessie had been so furious with her grandmother that while the grill boy's back was turned, she lifted a package of Twizzlers from the counter and slid it into her skirt pocket. Again, she'd waited for a hand to clamp on her shoulder, announcing she'd been caught, but none came. My tennis lessons started out badly, but have gotten better since I asked for a new instructor. Her name is Susie, short for Susan. She was named for Susan B. Anthony, who, in case you weren't paying attention in history class, fought for women's right to vote. The cool thing is that Susie is a feminist just like Susan B. Anthony. She told me on the first day that she only accepts female tennis students because the world has enough male tennis stars as it is. She also told me she found out she was being paid less than the male tennis instructors at Field and Oar, and she marched right up to Ollie Hayward, the head of tennis, and she threatened to quit if he didn't give her equal pay. Ollie said yes, probably not on principle, she says, but because Susie is the best player of all the instructors. Jessie stops there, though she could talk about Susie all day. Susie has short hair like a boy, bright red due to her Irish heritage, and pale, pale skin. She has to play tennis in a white long-sleeved shirt so her skin doesn't burn, and she paints her nose with zinc. When Jessie told Susie that Garrison Howe said she didn't have enough arm strength for a one-handed backhand, Susie said, "Let me tell you something about Garrison Howe." Jessie held her breath. She waited for Susie to confide that Garrison had rubbed his tumescence against her as well. "He's a half-witted sewer rat," Susie said.
"He is?" Jessie said.
"He is," Susie said. "But name-calling is for the weak. Actions are for the strong. Got it?"
"Got it," Jessie said.
"I've had 4 lessons so far, and I'm just starting to get the hang of it. I can hit a decent forehand, and my backhand clears the net at least half the time. I also know how to score the game. Love, 15, 30, 40, game. 6 games wins a set, but you have to win by 2 games. 2 sets wins a match for women, 3 for men. Susie feels it should be 3 sets for both sexes. Tennis is the most male-biased sport in the world, she says. Next week, I'll learn to serve. Susie says she's had great luck teaching kids to serve. The junior champion here was once her student. Other than that, nothing to report." This isn't precisely true. Jessie wants to tell Tiger what happened with Pick, but Tiger is her brother, and Jessie isn't sure how he would handle it. She has considered writing about it to Leslie or Doris, but it feels too new and too private to share. When Kate and David came home from dinner at the Skipper, Kate started crying and woke Jessie up. She knew her mother missed Tiger, that she worried every second of every day that he would be shot and killed or, worse, captured and tortured. Her baby, her only baby boy. Jessie lay in the dark listening to them talk in the kitchen, her eyes wide open as she, too, imagined the fates that might have befallen Tiger. Without a letter, it was impossible to know if he was okay.
David said all the right things. The tiger was strong and fast, and, despite his disappointing grades, he was smart. He had a good understanding of the physical world, how to take things apart and put them back together. Most of all, he was mentally tough. David's words put Jesse at ease, but Kate still cried, and David took her to their bedroom. Once the door was closed, all Jesse could hear was her mother's muffled sobs. Jesse realized she was starving. The peanut butter sandwich had been skimpy, and so she tiptoed downstairs for a snack. She saw a flash of white moving outside the window, and she froze for an instant, wondering if the house was haunted after all, if the ghost of Ebenezer Raymond or one of his children might be floating around. But when Jesse moved closer to the window, she saw Pick in his t-shirt and Levi's, returning home from his shift at the North Shore restaurant. Without thinking twice, Jesse stepped out of the kitchen door onto the brick patio and whispered his name, Pick. He swung around, saw her, and waved her over. Jesse tiptoed across the patio and down the flagstone walk to where Pick was untying a parcel secured to the back of his bike. It was a cardboard takeout box.
Let's go up to the deck, he whispered.
They stepped lightly into Little Fair, past the closed door of Mr. Crimmins' room, and sneaked up the stairs. Jesse had forgotten that Little Fair had a deck that overlooked Plum Lane. In the past, Kirby and Tiger had smoked their marijuana joints there so that Kate and Exalta wouldn't detect the smell. The deck was small, just big enough for two people. Pick appeared with two green bottles and the cardboard box. At first, Jesse thought the bottles were beer, and she quickly calculated just how rebellious she wanted to be, but then she saw they were ginger ale. Still technically forbidden, but not nearly as bad. Pick sat on the deck next to Jesse and opened the box.
They give me leftovers every night, he said. It's Saturday, so we really scored big.
Jesse warmed at his use of the pronoun we, and also her stomach rumbled.
I'm starving, she admitted. My grandmother passed out before she could make me any dinner.
Bill told me your grandmother likes her gin, Pick said.
She does,
Jesse said, though she hardly thought it was a good idea for Mr. Crimmins to share this detail with Pick. But Jesse supposed that the family secrets would all be revealed, now that the Crimminses were living among them. Jesse eyed the cardboard box.
What did you get?
Pick unfolded the flaps. Meatloaf, he said, and cod cakes.
There's plenty, so help yourself.
Jesse loathed cod cakes and would eat meatloaf only under duress, but she was hungry, and she was so happy to be sitting alone with Pick that the food tasted more delicious than any she could remember. They both ate with their fingers, and a couple of times their hands met when they reached into the box. Then Pick